I want to acknowledge that a lot of the material that I'm going to talk about, or images that I've used, or cartoons that I've used, are from the sources listed on this slide, and I want to give appropriate attribution to all these sources. I may have missed a couple of attributions on individual slides, and my apologies to the authors for that. The bottom you see some good sources of advice on scientific writing. This is an outdated list. But personally, I found the two articles by Gopin and Swan, and by Gopin subsequently, as extraordinarily good material to read through. I'm going to begin with a little bit light humor about how all the world scientists are fretting. It's night in London and Deborah Dormouse is unable to sleep. She can't decide whether after 4 weeks of anxious waiting, it would be counterproductive to call a Nature editor about her manuscript. The answer to that is don't call the editor. And it's sunlight in Sydney and Wayne Wombat is furious that his student's article was rejected by Science. And he's taking revenge on similar work that he's reviewing for himself. A very common sentiment when you sit among editors that they talk about these. So it's not uncommon for editors and reviewers to be human. And in San Diego, Melissa Mariposa reads the article that was submitted to Current Biology. It will be reconsidered only if it is cut in half. And against her better judgment, she steels herself to throw out some key data and oversimplify the conclusions. Her postdoc really needs this journal on his CV to cut or not to cut. So we'll look at some of these issues as we go along. And I thought I would focus on four different areas over the course of about half an hour to 45 minutes, and then we can open it up for discussion. One is an overview of authorship responsibilities, because it's a little bit more than just writing a manuscript. And when you're talking about getting published, you'll realize that sooner or later you'll get embroiled in a number of controversies, which are related to some of the issues I will discuss. Simplest thing about choosing a journal. And then I want to unmask the editorial process. I want to talk about what really happens in the boardroom, because one of my pet peeves about some of the journals that I work for is that I think we really need to put it out there as to what happens in the editorial board. So it's not a black box for the authors. And I'll try to do it during this process over here. And then I'll talk about how do we process editorial decisions? How do editors make the decisions? How do reviewers make the decisions? And how do we process that? How do we re-strategize that? And how do we go about revising manuscripts? Some key tips, and I'll repeat these towards the end, and these are for all the early faculty people. Read many papers. Learn from good ones and bad ones. You become a better writer by being a better reader. Write frequently, because quality is everything. Some of my own papers, which I wrote a decade ago, I would probably rewrite them extensively. Review frequently, because that's how you get a gut sense of what is it that editors are looking for, what your fellow reviewers are talking about the same article that you review. So that gives us unique insights into multiple perspectives that editors often choose when they reach decisions. And the editors often communicate back with the reviewers as to why a decision is made. The fourth bullet is probably the most important one. Learn to be objective about your work. It's very hard to be objective about our own work. But I think the key to being able to publish successfully is being able to view our work a little bit objectively, moving away and trying to look at what we have done. Believe in the peer review system. Believe that editors and reviewers are likely to try to be objective about your work. They are your allies. They are not your adversaries. Learn to expect and accept rejection. Be more proactive, expect that, and strategize with plan A, plan B, plan C, and we'll talk about a little bit. The two key elements of publication are, you know, good science and good writing. And I think I sent Peter one of the articles which talks about what happens in the editorial board of the JAMA. And the article talks about the most common terms and discussions focus around three areas: science, journalism, and writing. Science and journalism for me actually fall under the same category over here, which is the ingredients of good science. Novelty of the idea. And timing. One of my mentors, Bill Cannell, has always told me that the most important thing that determines where you go with a manuscript is a question of time. Is it an important question at this particular point of time in the scientific community that you are hoping to address? Comprehensive review of the literature is always important, because The reviewers of your article will be people who are published in that area, and they don't like it if their important work is not really cited. Strong data, no question that to get published you need strong data, you need strong analysis. Frequently that means strong statistical input. Don't assume knowledge. I think our statisticians are terrific people who provide a lot of insights which I have learned from and continue to learn from all the time. Then the discussion has to be thought-provoking. I think this is the most key word over here. It has to really be objective. You have to be able to see and say, what is it exactly that you found? What does it exactly mean? And what does it not mean? And the more you clearly lay it out there, including acknowledging limitations of one's work, the more likely it is that people who are not you, who are reading this article, be they reviewers or readers, are likely to like what you do. The ingredients of good writing are known to all of you, but again, just to be redundant, good organizing of a manuscript is critical. Appropriate use of tables and figures. What do we put in figures? What do we put as tables? When do we use the same data that we put in tables? They are better presented as figures. Right length. The New England Journal, for example, often likes 2,700 words. You can say what you want to say in 2,700 words. That's how you get published in the New England Journal. The right audience. I think one of the most important things, and I'll talk about it, is that if you're trying to publish in a journal, have a good feel of what kind of articles the journal publishes. Who is the journal catering to? What are the last 6 months? Has there something related to your area of expertise or your area of research be published in that journal? Keeping that in mind would be important to try and target your journal, your article to the right journal. So let's start at the beginning. Why do we write and publish? And I'd like to think that most of us want to think that we want to share our research findings and discoveries in the hope of improving. Okay. That's the ideal side. But there's a practical side of things too. We also publish to get funded. We get published to get promoted, to get a job, and sometimes keep a job. So one of the important things to remember is that you've got to finish in order to publish. And it becomes a question of timing, that you could take a long time to finish what you really want to write. But at the end of the day, scientists are rated by what they finish and by not what they attempt. So finishing the work is important. And the most important thing about publishing, being published, is starting with the good research questions. Sometimes it's good to just step back and think about a series of research questions which are sort of complementary or talk about different angles before you really launch into the research question of interest, because any research question that you research, it's going to take up a considerable amount of your talk. Simple, we all know about this. I think Peter covered this, the IMRD format for manuscript structure. I just want to focus on the notion of when you write, think about the hourglass model. You want to begin the first sentence of your introduction by being a little bit general as to why is this area important. Then come down to a specific research question, because this is the way I describe it. You've got truth in the universe and you've got truth in the study. So you begin with trying to see why is it important to talk about truth in the universe. Then come down to what is the truth that I can identify in my specific study. That's probably the last sentence of your introduction, which is particular. And then you go down to your own study, your specific methods, your specific findings. And then towards the end of the manuscript, you have to generalize that you found the truth in your study, but what does it mean for the truth in the universe? Because that's what the readership, which is not your study and not in your research group, is looking for. First impression, and I really want to spend time telling you that the first draft that is submitted to a journal is probably your best shot at publication. So you really have to give it your best shot, because after that it's a series of downhill rejections with occasional acceptance. So give it your first shot, and I think this is coming from a journal itself, a journal editor itself, who is saying that, first impressions. So catching the eye of the editor and the reviewers is extraordinarily important. Learn to say things simply. And this is some of the things I always tell my fellows, because they end up thinking that I rewrite a lot of what they write. And partly it is because I think there's a fair amount of granularity and depth in the way they think. We are phenomenally read. I learned much more from my fellows than from actually my peers. They send me so many articles every week that I find that I really have to sit down and read. But a manuscript is not an encyclopedia of information. It's a short manuscript. You're trying to get a point across. It's a classic example of We begin with William Faulkner. Just to read it out for you. Loving all of it, even while he had to hate some of it, because he knows now that you don't love because you love despite. Not for the virtues, but despite the faults. If you read this sentence, and you have to read it about 3 times to understand what William Faulkner is actually meaning, doesn't help in a scientific manuscript. I contrast it with the Hemingway style. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know. There's a good example over here where he was challenged to write six, tell a story in 6 words. And he wrote, "For sale, baby shoes, never worn." Done. So, learning to write in simple sentences, more like Hemingway rather than Faulkner, and trying to use active voice, trying to use strong words, and to tighten your writing. I like to rewrite what I write several times over. Use common words, and give you examples where people use some words and I change them back to common words, because that's the way the flow seems far more appealing to the readership. And avoid jargon. I find a lot of people use a lot of jargon, at least among the circles that I work with, and never goes well with reviewers, because they really don't understand what you mean when you use jargon. Always spell out acronyms. Don't trust spell check. You'll find that spell check lets you down a number of times when it really doesn't understand what you're trying to say. And again, proofread, because like I said, your first impression is probably your best chance at getting published. So you usually make a choice of your first journal. That's probably the best and the highest tier journal that you think your article can get into. Give it the best shot that you can. So here are examples of words that you, simpler words that you could use instead of the, I would say, about, begin. And this is a very common one. People say utilize, I often change it back to use. They say finalize, they just say finish. So this is just idiosyncratic ways of writing. I'm telling you my personal style, give it or take it. But this is something which I found has worked over the years. And then if you can say something in one verb, try and avoid, you know, long sentences. For example, you could just say adjust, judge, decide, investigate, refer. Try to write simply. And ultimately, you have to do a lot of wordsmithing, and you know, instead of saying in the present time, you can say now, maybe that, perhaps. And sometimes less is more. When it comes to writing, less pithy and being succinct is probably much better. The new drug caused a decrease in heart rate. They say, new drug decreased heart rate. Tissue samples were weighed, then frozen, and analyses were performed. All you need to say is, tissue samples were weighed, frozen, and analyzed. So you can get rid of a lot of words, because you're trying to reach up to 3,000 words or 6,000 words, depending on the target journal. Be careful that the editors are often aware of what exactly you're saying. When you say to the best of the author's knowledge, you probably mean you're too lazy to do a literature search. But when you say that, you know, it should be noted that, probably means that, you know, my experiment weren't perfect. And, you know, they can read very well. That's what editors do. And Emilia can testify to this. We read and reread articles submitted to circulation several times over. And I circle out some of these phrases to try and understand what is it exactly that they're trying to tell us. The importance of drafts. And this is just an idea. I try to do at least 2 or 3 drafts before I send it out to authors, because I don't like what I read today, day after tomorrow. I find that reading something at the same time, you often get bogged down, you develop fatigue. So you want to keep it aside, read it out for a couple of days, then you find that you're starting to rewrite it, and iteratively, it generally reads much better. And once you're done with a couple of drafts, progress, not perfection. Send it to your co-authors, they are part of the team, they have to contribute actively to the manuscript as well. And generally, if you have a good third draft, I think that's the point where you want to circulate to a larger group of co-authors. And the final document is when you start really proofing and reading and making sure that you've read the instructions to the journal very carefully, what exactly they want, how they want the references formatted, how they want the tables done. Like I said, your first impression is the best impression that you have in front of a journal. Be aware that this is the circle of academia. Revision, rejection, rejection, occasional acceptance. This is the rule no matter how senior you are, no matter how junior you are. It's not necessary that if somebody is a professor, they get their papers accepted more often. And generally, journals are, generally I want to say, blind to seniority of the authors. They look for innovative science. I'm not going to spend a lot of time about, but I think it's nice to know that you should be aware and acknowledge conflicts of interest, be aware about duplicate publication, plagiarism, especially if you're working with fellows. I think it's extraordinarily important to emphasize that the best manuscript they can write is manuscript they write in their own language. Be aware of how your manuscripts score or add to prior publications. Be aware of fraud. I'm going to skip this slide because most of you probably know about conflicts of interest. My own interpretation is you're much better off disclosing something even if it is perceived rather than not disclosing. There's a lot of people out there today who are trolling the webs to see who is conflicted and who is not conflicted, and God bless them for finding out who's conflicted. But you want to be above board and disclose it, because it doesn't hurt to say that there could be a potential or perceived conflict of interest. And we have seen this happen with articles published in the New England Journal where people have consulted for drug companies or written editorials, and people have cried foul about that. Plagiarism, again, the one point I want to mention is about more auto-plagiarism, because we don't really think about it a lot. And sometimes when you're part of large studies, you can only say the same thing. Committee on Publication Ethics, and we meet frequently as editors at various national and international meetings to deal with this issue. It's better to be proactive and resolve authorship disputes rather than have to deal with it later on. Some of the personal examples that I've dealt with over the years and which I have evolved is that when people sign on to a manuscript, the first submission to the first journal, they sign on to the manuscript. I think that's an implicit agreement that I like to elicit from authorship, because we've had situations, because of the complexity of the group that I work with, where people have said at the galley stage that they don't want to be an author. Not negotiable. You had your chance. The first draft, the first manuscript, to the first journal, you signed on. So unless there are major violations and you don't totally agree with the results, you want to make sure that people sign on, they understand what exactly they are signing on. I think these are some of the principles that I have found useful over the years about authorship principles. Well, authorship leads to far more discontent than almost anything else in academia. Authorship, authorship order, senior author, first author, how do you attribute work, collaboration, contribution, these are all terms. So it's a whole separate talk I could give for an hour. But what I have found is, trying to be open about it and trying to be transparent, no surprises. We work as part of large consortia, and one of the keys is no surprises. And being able to talk about authorship, I think, is extraordinarily important. We hesitate to talk about authorship. And I think that's a pitfall. So within your group, wherever you work, I think you need to be proactive if you're the first author or the senior author to discuss authorship. Sometimes we get manuscripts where the authorship block is vacant. I don't like it at all. I think it's not fair. Personally, it has never mattered to me, but I've always given feedback that write the people that you think are authors in alphabetical order and tell them that the final order would be decided based on contributions. Make that communication happen. Talk to people why they think they have been bumped or not bumped or whatever. The less you talk, the deeper you will find that people have feelings about these issues. One of the things that I've learned as senior author is to keep a team perspective and be aware that different people view contributorship very differently. It's a very complex world out there. Teams tend to be multidisciplinary. By nature, most of the work you'll be doing is going to be multidisciplinary. A lot of people are going to contribute. And a lot of them will think they have contributed the key thing that will get something published in a particular journal. So addressing these proactively is, I think, important. I think the reason it's important is that you really want to enjoy the process of writing. You don't want to be left feeling not good about it. So I think enjoying the process and feeling good about it depends upon some of the principles of, fairness, openness, communication, and understanding that varying perspectives on what is contributorship and what is authorship. And this is a joke slide and meant to draw your attention to the first author being a senior grad student. He made the figures. The second author was a grad student in the lab, nothing to do with the project, was included because he/she hung around the group, usually for food. The third author, the first year student who actually did the experiments, performed the analysis, wrote the whole paper. Thanks. Things being third author is quite fair because his perspective is very different. The middle author, the author names nobody really reads, reserved for undergrads and technical staff. The second to last author is an ambitious assistant professor or postdoc who instigated the paper. And the last author is a head honcho. Hasn't even read the paper. But hey, he got the funding. And it's famous name that we get the paper accepted. These are not the authorship criteria that you want to follow. A little bit about what constitutes redundant publication. Data in a conference abstract No, you can have a publications in an abstract form. It doesn't constitute redundant publication. Same data in a different journal? Yes. No, you can't do this. Data on a website? Maybe. This is one of the tricky ones, and it's one of those gray zones which I tend to best avoid. I think years ago we had a rule which is still there from the New England Journal called the Engelfinger rule, brought out by Franz Engelfinger, who was trying to defend the right of journals to actually publish and make profit. So it's an active thing which is being contested by a lot of people, including the Faculty of Thousand, who believe that they can take something from different articles and publish them before they are published. Generally, journals such as the New England Journal frown upon it. Journals such as the JAMA are also divided. I think about 3 or 4 years ago, I think one of the senior editors of JAMA, Raman Rennie, I'll describe an episode, personal interaction with him later on. He took on the side that, the Engelfinger rule has to be ruled out. That we don't really need the Engelfinger rule. But he could not even convince JAMA to actually follow up on that. So I tend to tell people not to let data appear on websites because it could end up that you miss a chance to publish in journals because they are operating according to a different set of rules and don't really want to enter into a discussion with authors. Data can be included in a review article, yes, but only if it is published later. I think Emilia dealt with this issue where one of the review articles written by one of her colleagues included original article before it had been published in a journal, and there was a series of things that had to happen subsequently to deal with this. Expansion of a published data set, you had 100 patients and then you made it 150 patients and you made it 200 patients. Generally, it's counted as redundant publication unless you're able to clearly justify in your cover letter, acknowledge it, send a copy of the old paper, be as transparent as possible. Moving on to choosing the right journal. I think this is very important. And like I said, knowing the journal that you're submitting to and being able to read a few articles and seeing have they published in your area of interest, when did they last publish? That gives you a sense and that avoids disappointment because you can send something to a journal and then be rejected, but that was because it wasn't the right choice to begin with. We often go by what we call as impact factors, which refers to the average number of times papers are published or cited up to 2 years after publication. For example, an impact factor for circulation in 2011, the way they would calculate it is they look at the number of articles published in 2009 and 2010, and they look at the number of times these papers have been cited. One paper, you take number of times it has been cited and divide it by the number of papers that circulation published. So it's a simple mathematical formula. The immediacy index refers to how often a paper is cited during the year of publication, how important it is. And some of the top journals, and I'll show you an examples of this, have high impact factors and high immediacy index. So you can see this is probably for 2009, New England Journal right on top, impact factor of 47. Lancet, JAMA, some of the medical journals appear. I know some of you are interested in the cardiovascular journals, so right there you see circulation 14.8, General American College of Cardiology 12.6. I know there's a neurologist amongst you, so impact factor of Nature Review Neuroscience is 26. So knowing the impact factor of the journals that you publish in is important, but it's not the sole criteria. I think ultimately you're looking for a fit, so never be driven just by the impact factor. And I think a lot of the fellows we work with are disappointed if they don't manage to publish in the New England Journal. I think what I like to tell them is that the quality of work we do is the same regardless of where it appears. If you ask a good research question, you get it published in a good journal. Whether or not it gets into the New England Journal often is a matter of chance. I can tell you personally that at least a few of the articles I published in the New England Journal never should have gone to the New England Journal in the first place. We just got lucky. I think somebody said maybe give it a shot. So I was surprised that actually the New England Journal was interested. I'd have been happy if circulation took those papers. So the reason choosing the right journal is important, and here is a quote from one of the editors of CHEST that if you choose a journal, a top-tier journal with extremely stringent peer review criteria, but your study is not of sufficient quality, it may just end your motivation for resubmission. You really deal with a downer because you get back very harsh criticism, or sometimes it's rejected without review, and that feels very hurtful. And there, I think the issue was that you made a choice which probably wasn't very prudent to begin with. On the other hand, you could choose a low-tier journal and get your article in it fairly quickly, and you could get it on your CV, but nobody would ever bother with it. So you have to try and understand that who is it that I'm wanting this research finding to be disseminated amongst? Who's the target audience? And what journal the target audience is trying to reach? This particular message, this particular study, where do I really want to target it? And typically what we try to do is that, especially when we work with fellows and all, we enter into a discussion process and talk about the pros and cons of publishing in various articles for a specific manuscript. It's always a question of a specific manuscript that is on the table and trying to work through and guess. It's a guessing game. I'm not sure I'm very good at it, but I think it keeps getting better in terms of trying to predict where you would get published. The cover letter. Perspectives on the cover letter vary a lot. I think as an editor, I like to read all the cover letters that I get. I'm not sure about what you think, Emilia. I like to read the cover letters because I write cover letters. So I like to read what other people write just to get a sense of what is it that you want to tell me that I should review. So typically the cover letter is, we are pleased to submit this article for publication in Circulation. Done. It's not telling me anything. So often people say that, especially when you're looking for high impact journals, and this is a quotation from one of the editors of Science, that you want to provide, that's the second quotation at the bottom. And it says, try to explain to them the logic of the paper. The cover letter is also a forum, and nowadays you have online boxes where you can exclude reviewers or suggest reviewers. I have mixed feelings about suggesting reviewers. It's a question of errors of commission versus errors of omission. In my experience as an editor, the authors often exclude reviewers and they are the ones actually who are most favorable to their work. Editors often will choose an excluded reviewer against the words of the author, but typically it would happen when work on a particular area is done by a limited group of people. I can tell you, for example, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, there are about five groups that work in the world. So if an author says to exclude four of them, you can't get a peer review. So you do go around them, but you keep in mind that, you know, the author is conscious. The author is conscious about the fact that they want to exclude somebody. So as an editor, I have to be conscious that this may not be a fully unbiased review. Suggesting reviewers is a good idea. I think what people I have seen as an editor make the major mistake is that they suggest friends. So all you need to do is a PubMed and realize that they're suggesting people they work with. Sometimes you know that these are actually people they are collaborating actively with. So if you really want to suggest reviewers, go beyond your circle and suggest impartial people from outside. For example, I would typically pick a European reviewer if I ever dare to suggest a reviewer, because I tend to avoid it unless there are some journals that insist that you have to name reviewers, otherwise you can't move forward on the submission form, in which case you do suggest. Not a whole lot.
There's a question that exists.
Sure.
There might be a really obvious answer to this. Why do
you... Because they think that somebody is working on the same gene, the same area, and would negatively review their manuscript, so they don't expect favorable or an unbiased review. So they'd rather exclude the people. Journals have their way around getting around this. I can tell you as an insider that sometimes, you know, we are conflicted, but we handle manuscripts. And the manuscript will be signed by the editor-in-chief. The author would not know that it's been handled. But generally, we have a good debate or discussion over it, about our ability to handle something in which we could be potentially conflicted. And the reason it comes up is that often the reason you are a reviewer or handling a manuscript because it's your specific domain. So why would you hand it over to somebody else who has got less expertise? So often the editor-in-chief would make a choice that, having disclosed your conflict, I'd like you to continue to handle this. In which case the final letter would go under the signature of the editor-in-chief. So journals tend to be very thoughtful. They spend a lot of time discussing potential conflicts. When there's an editorial board meeting and a paper is discussed on any author that I have collaborated with in the last 2 or 3 years or I'm actively collaborating with, I would disclose it and then try to leave the room. Sometimes I'm told that I'd like you to comment and then you leave the room so that we can make our own, you know, comments, and then we leave the room. So we're not party to the discussion that actually goes on in the editorial boardroom. So that's a long-winded answer to your short question.
It's increasingly difficult, this business of conflict with these, like, you know, when you have like 100 people in a field as a co-author, I mean, it almost becomes impossible, both the study section and also with grants. And, you know, so then kind of judge like how close the relationship is.
Okay. And as a note, though, do you suggest to exclude viewers or to leave it just you know, bad? You look bad, not to look.
I have never excluded viewers. I don't like to exclude viewers because it's very complicated.
The devil that you know sometimes is better than the devil that you don't know.
But also, it just seems like a red flag for the authors.
I think it typically happens when people are working on the same area, same gene, and they are rushing and they want to make sure that somebody is excluded. We tend to respect that. What I do is that when an author tells me that they want to exclude somebody, I do a literature search on both the author and the other person and try to judge for myself what is the amount of overlap. Will I get an unbiased review or not get an unbiased review? I may choose to go around, in which case we have annotations where I can make a note that there is a potential conflict with this author. I am selecting an author who has a reviewer who has been excluded by an author. I like to document. Everything that I do, I have to be open and responsible, and there has to be some documentation. So there has to be an electronic trail somewhere. So when we go against the grain and do this as an editor, I would document it in some way or form so that I am aware of it, because, you know, the decisions come back, then I've forgotten by then, 3 months into the process, that I have a review from somebody the authors wanted to exclude. But then there's a box over there that tells me, Vasan, this reviewer is conflicted, be careful. So I look at it and then I reprocess it. So we tend to be thoughtful. This is an example of a cover letter I wrote to Catherine De Angelis about a paper published in JAMA. And this is how not to write a cover letter. Because this was a manuscript actually, which is over. And nothing in this cover letter actually is incorrect. It's on the lifetime risk of hypertension. And this was early on where I learned that, you know, you have to sell your manuscript into a journal. So we're writing to the JAMA. This was the first choice of journal. We wanted to send it to JAMA. It eventually got published to JAMA fairly in quick time. This went to Drummond Rennie, who's a senior JAMA editor whom I really respect. And he wrote me, and I was very surprised. JAMA is one of those interactive kind of journals where I got an email. He said he wanted to talk. I was very pleased. The first thing he said was, I need to tell you, don't write a cover letter like this. Let the readership, let the reviewers judge how important your work is. So after that, I really toned down the language and never, you know, everything in this is actually correct, but it did not go well, and I learned. I think another one was, Emilia would remember this, about a manuscript we did where it came back with the review. I learned the word solipsistic. It said that the authors had a solipsistic universe, opinion, view of a universe that was far more diverse than what they saw. It was hurtful to get that, so I think one of the things is to learn to be more objective, no matter how important you think our work is.
We've tone down. That one to 7 journals. That paper.
Then what should you focus on in your cover letter? If you're not, I'm confused because you said you want to sell it, but not too much.
Some of the things I would remove is, I would remove the bold.
Right.
I would say, yet information regarding lifetime risk is conspicuously lacking.
All right.
And that's too forward, trying to tell people that they really have not done what's important, and here I am doing it. And saying it right for the first time. For the first time means I probably didn't review the literature well enough. I made that comment. So I would write a much simpler letter saying, we're pleased to submit this. This manuscript addresses the issue of lifetime risk of hypertension, an important condition. Our principal finding is that the lifetime risk of hypertension is about 90%. And we provide both short-term and long-term estimates for hypertension risk. We hope this manuscript is of interest to the readership of JAMA. Stop. I think there are a few hyperboles over here which didn't go well and which I learned the hard way. I thought I needed to make a sales pitch. Didn't go well. It went to a senior editor, and the first thing he told me on the phone was, don't write your cover letter like this. And I learned it. A little bit about the editorial process so that you understand. One of the things that happens is that if you don't follow instructions to submission to the journal, you delay the publication of your journal. For example, you make a submission to Circulation. After a week, it will come back to the senior author saying that your word count was off, your references were not off. Because the first thing that is done when you send it is, an editorial assistant is trying to look at the formatting of the journal. The word count, the abstract word count, the formatting of the references. They look for, in Circulation, we look for 3 or 4 catchphrases. Is there a statement about approval of the study by the Ethics Advisory Board or the IRB? Is there a statement that the author takes responsibility for the data? It has to, that specific sentence is given in the instructions. You have to write that same sentence. And then the conflict of interest. Is it stated or not whether the authors have a conflict of interest? If these parts are missing, you lose a week, because the editorial manager takes time. So after a week, he or she will send it back to you and say to the senior author, deficient manuscript. So then you have lost a week. So you're better off trying to do the homework and not losing that week and doing it. So an editorial manager typically looks and screens for compliance with the journal instructions, and then it goes to the editor-in-chief. The editor-in-chief will then decide, the first decision the editor-in-chief makes is, should it be rejected without review or should I let this go forward? So it could be rejected without review. Typically the way, just to reassure you, I do reject things without review as an editor and as an editor-in-chief. I usually print out the article and I read it once because I find that reject without review is hurtful and people have sent it. So I think you want to be careful to make sure that if at all you would give the benefit of the doubt to the author and send it out for peer review. So reject without review means it really, really, really will never make it into this journal. So you can't be a permissive editor. You've got to be a bad cop and say, I draw the line here, this will never make it, I will exhaust my reviewers, I will exhaust my editors, reject without review. But usually it's a thoughtful process. So the editor-in-chief could reject without review or he could send it to an editor who handles it. For example, Dr. Lascalzo is the editor-in-chief of Circulation. He would send it to one of about 16, 20 associate editors. So it would come to me. And then I read it and I may decide to reject without review again and go against the grain of the editor-in-chief, because sometimes the editor-in-chief is looking at 50 manuscripts which have been submitted and quickly triaging it on a particular busy day. So I look upon it and say, do I really want to process this manuscript? Yeah, and the usual reasons for rejection without review is that it's incomprehensible. No matter how much I read it, I can't make sense of this. So I am not interested in going forward with it. It's mainly confirmatory of previously published work. So no matter how I look at it, there is no novelty. It has been said a dozen times. This is saying it a dozen plus one times. So it goes. The other reasons are the major weaknesses in design that just come out and pop out at you, that this is really not going to make it. I will exhaust my supply of good reviewers. So the one point to remember on this slide is that reviewers give opinion, but ultimately it's the editor who decides. And you have to believe in the peer review system that editors are thoughtful. Usually, I think to get into a high-tier journal, the most important criteria is novelty. Think of a good research question. Think of a question which has not been answered, a question for which the answer right now is timely. And mechanistic hypotheses often tend to score if coupled with novelty. I think these two together would get you into a high-tier journal. Yes.
Novelty. I've always been told by mentors not to say this is the first paper or no other paper. So how else do you emphasize novelty?
I think
not the thing that
reviewers and editors know the question. I think in your introduction you sort of spell it out, tone it down, but spell it out that here are the missing gaps in our knowledge. One of the strategies we have used, which I have personally used, is that often we would write a review article on a particular topic in parallel with trying to write a manuscript. I can give you a couple of examples. We have two manuscripts published with fellows, one on natriuretic peptides for screening for LV dysfunction and one on the natural history of asymptomatic LV systolic dysfunction. And we wrote two review articles in the Annals of Internal Medicine talking about epidemiology of asymptomatic LV dysfunction, what's known and what is not known. And you lay it out there. And usually these things are happening in parallel. When you come up with a good question, you do a good literature search, you identify what are the missing gaps in knowledge. Sometimes fellows turn that into a review article, and in parallel you're working with the science. So you've created a need, so to speak, for answering a question in parallel with your efforts to answer that question. Strategy that works pretty well. But the answer to your question is that, say it in the introduction, tone it down, don't make claims of novelty, because if something is really novel, people can really see it. It jumps at you.
When you were writing those reports, were they solicited, or did you publish?
No, they were unsolicited review articles we just sent to the Annals of Internal Medicine. Again, a good cover letter telling them what it is. I think pre-submission inquiries wasn't there in those days. I think nowadays you should make use of pre-submission inquiries. Having said that, I think it's a mixed bag. Most pre-submission inquiries, if you call me as an editor and say I'm interested, I'd say show me. Now, how can I judge based on an idea? And say, I'd like to see, because I don't want to miss something which is nice. So most journal editors will say, send it in. But having said that, you know, the benefit is that sometimes they can tell you that, no, we are not interested, or there's a similar review article already happening, the journal in the works that you are not aware of. So you save yourself the time of submitting to that journal. So there are some pros about using pre-submission inquiries. It's a mixed bag, may not be high yield, but certainly worth it if a journal permits it. Novelty is most critical. I think, like I said, you begin with a good research question. If you don't know something, and if the literature doesn't know something, it's a nice idea to begin. And what I tell a lot of the people I work with, and I try to do that myself, among all the journals, I think the most careful pieces I usually read are the editorials. I think you look at the editorials, they're usually written by experts. Most people who write editorials, the last paragraph usually spells out what are the future directions, what are the unanswered questions. So going over the editorials in your particular area of interest over the last 6 to 9 months is a very good idea before you formulate a research question. This is what we routinely work with fellows. I tell them, read the circulation editorials for the last 6 months, editorials for Circ Research, ATVB. Then let's come back with some questions and some hypotheses and see what it is that we can answer. Editors are erratic. So editors are human, they are also erratic. Sometimes you come up with a decision that you really don't like. And I think what I'm going to plead here as an editor on both sides is that you probably see one side of the coin. Editors may appear erratic, but editors also work very hard. Editors generally tend to be pro-authors. Almost every editor's forum that I have participated in, and there are quite a few of these, most of the comments tend to be, how can we do a better job for our clientele, the authors? How can we serve them better? That's a major question that they do. Editors respect the peer review system. So if you have two reviews that come back that are really caustic, very, very hard for an editor to ignore those. Sometimes we go against the grain of the salt, against reviewers, and would get a third reviewer if we really believe and totally disagree with them. But you always struggle with the fact that you don't want to come across as judgmental and highly opinionated and disregard, you know, reviewers that you have yourself solicited. So there has to be some respect for the peer review process. And remember that when you get a rejection letter, probably somebody at the other end who has signed it has struggled with it. And they spent some time thinking about it. It's not the push of a button and you get a rejection letter. That our own, I can tell you about circulation, where we debate decisions. We typically give authors the benefit of the doubt. In circulation, we have layers. You could get a response which is a de novo reject. That means that come back, there are major issues. You could get a response which is revise, meaning we liked it but needs a lot more work. Seldom, if ever, would you get in the first submission something which is the next category, which is accept with revision. So we have categories of reject without review. That means it never went out for review. Or you have de novo reject. That's the usual decision I have got from circulation, is that we like your work, but there are major deficiencies. And I think a lot of time is spent in the editorial board debating over it. And generally, it ends up being favorable to the authors. We like to give authors a chance. We like data. Editors have a broader perspective than what you think, and I'll give you examples of that. And this point I mentioned, that we don't like involvement in authorship disputes. You're better off settling it before you reach the editors, because that generally weighs against you. If you have a manuscript and there are authorship disputes, different editors have different perspective. I try to deal with it and not penalize anybody for it. But I have seen editors who say, don't have time, don't need to deal with it, go elsewhere, go away. So you have to be very careful. And you don't blame them. They're dealing with a lot of, they are hardworking people. They have to prioritize that time just like all of us have to do. So they say that, I don't really want to deal with this. Rebuttals. Rebuttals are a big issue. I, for an editor, felt very awkward during my initial 2 or 3 years because I didn't get any rebuttals. She told me that I probably wasn't doing a good job. That, you know, you like rebuttals because you like authors to tell you that they didn't like your decision. Generally, having said that, rebuttals don't work. I don't rebut. They have never worked in my experience of anything that I have handled, because generally editors go and seek third reviewer or a fourth reviewer not related to the first two who rejected your art. Generally, in my experience, and I've handled quite a few rebuttals, the third and the fourth reviewers say the same thing as the first and second reviewers. So it's a waste of time. Unless you're really dying hard and that's all you want to do is publish in just this particular journal, you are better off saving your time for fighting a battle at another journal, because the journal has said no, take no for an answer and move on. unless you feel that the reviewers, both reviewers, were blatantly unfair, the editor really missed the point, and you really, really want to go back to this. I'm going to skip this slide. This is in some of the articles that I sent over to Peter, and just re-emphasizing some of the things I've said, that generally editors like manuscripts which are novel, which are accurate, which are important. Erratic reviewer. Be aware that the reviewers you get, you have to we try to pick, generally as an editor, I'd like to pick two reviewers who offer a different perspective. If something is very controversial, I'd pick one on either side of the fence, because that gives me a balanced perspective. So don't get upset if you get reviews that appear contradictory. That may well be because the editor has thought about it and obtained those kind of contradictory opinions. Because science tends to be a discussion. It's not as simple as it appears. So sometimes fellows have come and they're very upset with a review, they think. And I usually tell them, meet me after 2 days. Let's process it. Let's see. Let's try and understand. Maybe there's a grain of truth in what the reviewer is saying. If your paper is returned for revision, de novo revision or revision, you are in good shape. You may still not like the comments, but they left the door open a crack. And now it's up to you how you get into that door. And really try to understand what the reviewers are saying. You really have to be, take yourself out of your shoes, stand outside and say, what if the reviewer is right? How can I best respond to the reviewer? Remember that the reviewers hold the cards. They are the ones who reject or whatever, give you a grade for your manuscript. So it's not that you're sucking up to the reviewers. You're giving them the benefit of the doubt and the respect, saying that what if they were right? How do I best respond? And look for clues from the editor as to what exactly they need. Usually the cover, the letter that goes to the author, at least in circulation and some of the journals I work for, we try to be very specific. And I'll give you examples of this verbiage. This is an example of just a recent manuscript that I co-wrote with some of my colleagues, where I'm giving an example of how I like to respond to reviewers. That may be just one way. Typically, I like to write down exactly the way the comment appears, write out a response. I'm not sure the bold came through in this, but we try and thank the reviewers. We try and do what they want us to say. If you feel that it doesn't belong in the paper, we often put it, you know, we provide them with what we call as reviewer tables and try to incorporate the additional information into supplementary tables. The more you work with the reviewers and the more you work with the editors, you'll be pleasantly surprised how much they want to work with you. The major reasons for rejection often, I think the top reason is that there isn't a fit. You send it to the New England Journal does not deal with this kind of art. Or you send it to the JAMA, and JAMA just published something on this 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And merely confirmatory or incremental work typically does not get into a high tier journal. And again, you know, poorly written design studies, there is no salvage for these. The other reasons which may not be very obvious to you, and therefore I want to spend a few minutes on this, that you don't know what other manuscripts are in the pipeline for a journal. There are two other manuscripts that deal with a similar theme, because when you think you've got a good idea, be sure that 1,000 people elsewhere have got the same idea. And some of them may be faster than you are. So, you know, be aware that sometimes the rejection has nothing to do with it other than it's not a priority, because, you know, right now they have similar manuscripts in the pipeline that are being waiting over there. And also, I think journals vary in terms of what we call in circulation as the tank. Is the tank full today or is the tank empty? Because there are periods when you need manuscripts. So if you're lucky enough and it's a random process that your paper lands on a particular day when we need to produce more manuscripts from the next journal, we change our acceptance ratio based on how full the tank is. Again, these are some of the things which I think we need to write about so that the process of what happens in the boardroom can be unmasked. It tends to be very pro-author. It tends to be random. But it tends to be reality. This is what happens in the boardroom. And I dealt with this issue about, you know, is it really timely and is it really what the priority is? For example, there are a few areas that are priority for circulation, which I know they would invest in. The other things that they would not be interested in. Give you an example, if you write a paper on vector cardiogram, it's a technology that's about three decades old. So even if you have done the most novel, innovative science on the vector cardiogram and you come up with a novel finding, it may or may not interest. there's language about reading the rejection letter, and I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on this. There is something which we call as conditional rejection, and then there is something which we call as outright rejection. And different journals use different language, but this nice table sort of gives you examples of this. For example, when an editor is telling you unacceptable in its current form, it means that maybe it's acceptable in its not current form. So, will require major revisions is clearly inviting you to submit. Will be more suitable as a brief report. Then you have to think, how badly do I want to make it to this journal? If this journal really has a high impact factor, serves the kind of people that I want to talk to, maybe it's not a bad idea to convert it into a brief report. I was talking to one of my colleagues, Christopher Newton Jay, yesterday from the Broad, where they were talking about a paper which will get into Nature as a letter. Is a letter in Nature better compared to a full report in Nature Genetics? And he was asking my opinion. I said a letter in Nature would always be more important. It's a very clear choice that Nature is a far more widely read audience as compared to Nature Genetics. So if I have to make the choice, I would make that choice. But then you have to balance the pros and cons. Do you want a letter or do you want a major report? And the reviewers have raised serious concerns that need to be addressed. That's the language of what I call a de novo, meaning it's iffy. You really, really need to work hard and address the reviewers, because the reviewers probably are very unhappy with the paper. But the editors left the door open a crack. Rejection with referral to another journal in the family, this is a very difficult one. For example, you send to the JAMA and it comes back, we'd like to refer it to Archives of Internal Medicine. That's a particularly specific example which I struggle with, because 9 out of 10 times when that happened to me, I think within 2 weeks, Archives has sent back saying they are not interested. So although they belong to the AMA family, I think the Archives is looking upon that, and I can see them saying that this is rejected material from JAMA and we are not here to take rejected material. And I think another issue comes up within the circulation family itself. I think people deal with it, that the major journal, mother journal Circulation, is not interested. They say refer to Circulation Heart Failure. So do you take it or do you not take it? For Circulation, I can tell you that generally when we refer to a daughter journal, there's a good chance you will get in there. So when they refer to another journal in the family, different journals mean different things. It's not always a shoo-in. Some journals are far more, mean serious business, others don't. So here's a nice flow chart that you can, when you get a rejection letter, determine what type of rejection it is. Is it an outright rejection or is it a conditional rejection? If you give up here, obviously you have no chance of publication success. But conditional rejection means that if you really, really do a good job and are really, really responsive and you really manage to drive home all the points and work hard on it, you have a pretty good chance at publication, because this is probably the first decision for most journals, most articles you submit to journals. Outright rejection means that you have to go back and introspect, take some time, try and decide why did it not work. Do the reviewers really mean what they said? Was it a wrong fit for the journal? Was it because, the editor picked the wrong kind of reviewers? So you really introspect and decide, and that's where I talk about being objective about your own work. No matter what you do, don't take it personally. It's not meant to be a personal rejection. It's a rejection of a manuscript. It's not a rejection of the study. It's not a rejection of the idea. It's not a rejection of the hypothesis. It's a rejection of what you sent in as a package. So maybe the package was not properly configured, maybe it was not properly organized, maybe there were references you didn't mention and the reviewer is telling you that here are 3 references that were mentioned, or here is important work that you actually missed, which was, doing it. And here's some actual data that of the rejected manuscripts, and what you see here in the second column is the speciality. Most of the rejected articles to the first submission journals eventually get published. And eventually get published over a period of 2 years. So the good news is that eventually you will get published. The take-home message here is that probably you didn't match it to properly to the first submission journal, and that's why it got rejected. Probably it went to a higher tier journal. And my own philosophy is that what Yogi Berra says, luck is the number of times you play the game. Till you try, you'll never know. And I gave you personal examples where fellows wanted to send something to the New England Journal. I said, sure, take your chance. And actually things got published in the New England Journal. I didn't think they stood a chance. So take your chance. And it's a very difficult conversation as trying to how important the finding is, how quickly you want it published, where which stage of your career you are. When you send out something to a journal like the New England Journal, it's read by a lot of people. And it's a very complicated world over there. A lot of them have similar data sets. A lot of them can publish faster than you do. A lot of them, their definition of ethics may be a little bit different from our definition of ethics. So it tends to be more complicated. Towards the end, I want to touch on a few important items because this really is going to muddy the waters. So a lot of what I said is a conventional framework, but three things are happening, and as editors, we ourselves don't know how to deal with this. One is this issue of open access journals, and I know for circulation and the American Art Association has an open access journals. We have a major retreat in July to try and address this issue of open access journals and the role of social media. And open peer review. The biological sciences have been a little bit different from the physical sciences. To give an example, if you pick up, I'm forgetting, it's one of the December issues of Nature. The opening editorial is Respond Now. This deals with a story that an article was published in Nature, which talked about a Pseudomonas bacterium found somewhere, and they claimed that it showed that there's life on the moon or something like that. I think they found arsenic and they made some interpretation. From arsenic, they jumped to Pseudomonas and claimed that life was on moon. And, you know, a lot of people wrote online about that article. And the series of critiques, and the Nature editor found himself in a spot. And he went back to the authors and said, how do you respond? And the author said, we respond only to peer-reviewed commentary. We don't respond to online blogs and what people are saying. Then I think the Nature editor wrote this editorial saying, respond now. He says that the peer review system has its faults. An article may be submitted to Nature, may be reviewed by a couple of reviewers, but there's an online community there that is giving a scathing review of work that has been published by you. You cannot hide behind the mask of saying that I will respond only to peer reviewed, you know, letters to the editor. And the Nature verdict was, respond now. These are very valuable things. Otherwise, we will publish these and we will take on writing an editorial. I think the same thing happened with one of the articles which was published from this very institution on aging and SNPs associated with aging, and now sciences dealing, asked for additional studies from the senior author, and it's an active. So journals are changing the way they work because there's an online peer review committee. And I believe physics journals have been working like this for a long period of time. That they actually attract, the physical sciences attract open peer review commentary, and authors are expected to respond to that. So the way the biological sciences and the impact of social media are going, it's sort of a moving target. And I can tell you, for circulation cardiovascular genetics, we a journal I work with, I and a senior deputy associate editor have discussed the idea of opening up a blog, inviting commentaries. I think it's like opening the Pandora's box, because it means a lot of time. How do you moderate the blog? Who are the, what are the rules for the blog? Who can post, who cannot post? And can you cite that as a, you know, in your CV as something you have written? So this is an evolving area. Another evolving area is what I call as joint online authorship. And I didn't, that was the last set of slides I wanted to send you, like, with examples of where I think you find for journals such as Nature Genetics, they are now inviting joint contributorship on a particular theme. And there are websites like WikiGenes and BioStar, where people are joining together. You write one part, you write another part, and it's being synthesized online as we speak. I don't know what it means. All I can tell you is that this is going to change, that some of the rules that I've told you today may be swept aside in another 5 years, because I think the media, the way we communicate has changed. The way people are reaching out has changed. The way people are commenting has changed. I think currently, for example, in terms of promotion standards, at least for Harvard, I can tell you that starred first authorship and starred last authorship doesn't really count. First, last is what counts. So while we can star ourselves as much as we want, some of the promotion mechanisms are quite distanced from reality. So will that change? I think it will change. Will some of these joint online authorship or what citation of things that you write online, how do you judge that when it comes to promotions? It's a moving target, and I think people are choosing at this point to calibrate. That's what we are doing as a journal. We are trying to get the information, we are trying to get the input, and we are trying to calibrate as to where do we want to come down. We don't want to rush into this. We are aware that this is the way publication is moving, that people are moving into e-publication, people are moving into publishing and open access journals and how best to deal with it is something which I want to just point out that it's a moving target. Just to recap some of the main points that I began with, read many papers. You are as good a writer as how much you have read. Write frequently. I like to write all the time because that's how you become a better writer. Review frequently because that provides unique perspective. We often view reviewing for journals as service we provide to the scientific community, but I think it's a very unique learning opportunity as well. When you review, you see what's out there in the next 6 months. And so when you get a request for reviewing, consider it seriously. It's not just a waste of time. It's not just, you know, service that you do. It's directly beneficial. Learn to be objective about your work. I can't say I've learned that myself, but I keep trying to remember this. Believe that editors and reviewers are likely trying to be objective. This part I can believe. Editors are on your side. I have played on both sides and continue to do on both sides of the fence as an author, as an editor. Learn to expect and accept rejection. This is the truth. This is what academics is about. Whether it's grants or whether it's you may send in the best product, it could be rejected. Ingredients of good science: novelty and timing, good literature review, strong data, thought-provoking discussion. Ingredients of good writing: good organization, right length, right audience, appropriate use of figures. And there's no way to get experience except through experience. The more you do it, better you get at it. I'm going to stop over here and, you know, I'll be happy to take any questions. Happy to give you examples, scenarios, vignettes of what really happens. Yes, ma'am.
Even if you create a mission, when you understand this, like publishing the same data, I can give you a scenario. Let's say we have a database of patients, and you can analyze the data differently. So you can pull a certain data from the same database and publish it, and then you can reanalyze it by different variables or in different way, or you can just analyze a subset of this patient. Can you publish it in another paper?
Right. I think theoretically, if you're using the same data to answer a different question, I think it's legitimate. I think the onus is on you to defend it. Remember, it's a slippery slope because people understand that. So pick and choose the battles. If that's really the battle you want to fight, what I would do is in the cover letter, make it very explicit to the editor that you have used this data to publish a particular manuscript in another journal or it's under review. If it's already published, send a copy of it. If it's under review, send a pre-publication copy of it. In the manuscript itself, in the introduction, say it in bold, say it explicitly that this is a follow-up of a data set that we have already used to answer this question. But here is a different question we are answering using the same data. The more you can argue your point and be transparent, the better off you are. What typically happens is not that. What typically happens is that you see a paper, you're sitting on an editorial board, and I can only talk about circulation where we have a lot of experience with. There are 20 editors and they're all smart people. Somebody, I would be presenting a paper, somebody would say, you know what, I've read this 2 years ago. There you are going on PubMed over there and there are 20 people searching and they come up. And we work for an editor-in-chief who's phenomenal. So typically he shows up with the paper beforehand because he's gone through 40 manuscripts the previous night and he shows and says, you know what, this has been published 2 years ago. Doesn't feel very good for the editor, doesn't feel very good for the author. So you deal with this issue where I think pick and choose your battles. If it's really, I think I can give you an example of Framingham. We use the data, same data all the time to answer 20 different questions. We make it very clear that the study question is different. The data sets are the same. So it's not really redundant publication if you're using the same data to answer a totally different question. I think the kind of example I'm talking about is, let's take an example of the natural history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And you have 100 patients and you publish that. And then you have 25 more. So a year later, you come back and say, the natural history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy expanded series, you added 25. Now, or you contribute the same 100 patients to, you know, a larger series, the natural history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a consortium, and there are 300 people. I think the editors and reviewers do the work. It's the same 100. They go to the baseline characteristics. We do a lot of detective work. We look at what you have published, we look at the baseline characteristics, and this is a very common, frequent comment in circulation that there's thematic overlap and there's actual overlap. The same 100 people were used, 5 people have been added in, 10 people have been subtracted in. Then you get down into nitty-gritty details. Why were 5 left out? Why did what really happened? So it's generally a slippery slope if you're using the same data set to answer the same question but in a broader framework. You may have to do that if you're participating as part of a consortium or whatever. Again, sending a copy of what you have done, saying it openly, saying it explicitly in clear English is probably the best way that I can think of. Emilia, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it also gets into the comment that you made earlier about least publishable unit. And I find that sometimes what we're doing it is it's what we call salami publishing. And it just, in the long run, it does a disservice to your career. You know, if you have a really good story, tell the story. And you may do, I'm actually doing this with Alan Walkie, where he analyzed it one way and he analyzed it another way. And I said, flip it. You know, put this analysis here, put the other analysis in an electronic supplement. And I think it increases the impact because essentially it's an internal sensitivity analysis.
So can you comment about maybe studies in terms of circulation, like, you know, like all at CARP? I think I saw a letter one day, like, the Journal of Medicine say they get more referenced more often and more likely to be published. Yeah, if the title of the study is like one of those funny acronyms. I think it was a few years ago, research and said, like, you know, CAR, all these other studies, like, a lot of the cardiac studies are named or come onto an acronym, more likely to be published, more likely to be referenced by other studies.
I can't say they get published just because of the acronym. I think typically the acronym is there because they are large trials of a kind. I wouldn't say the publication has much to do with the acronym itself. I would hesitate. I have handled a lot of all hat manuscripts at circulation which have been rejected. So I can give you the other side, and I have published a few of them. I think it depends upon the study question when you mine it. Large clinical trials do tend to get into major high-impact journals like JAMA, New England Journal, and Lancet. I think the main for these kind of journals, I think what they look for, and I'm a reviewer for these journals, is that will it change clinical practice? I think that's the bottom line. When I want to say something for the New England Journal or JAMA or Lancet, I always ask myself that if what I have to say, message, will it change public clinical practice or public health in a way that would be important? So if the answer to that is yes, you're more likely to be published. So even the studies with acronyms probably address important questions that have high clinical impact, change the way you treat hypertension or heart failure or whatever condition which are public health problems. So I dissociate the acronym or, you know, the profile. It is true that the New England Journal, for example, has been accused of being the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, mainly serving Boston and its interests. And the flip side of that, I can tell you, is that it's not very easy to get published in The Lancet unless you are from the United Kingdom. So it cuts both ways, and there is clearly a bias. And I think this was asked of one of the editors of the New England Journal. She was asked in a press conference, and she said that, yes, we are the New England Journal of Medicine. A lot more articles get from Boston. But remember that there are a lot of top institutions in Boston, and they ask a lot of important questions, and we know the quality of work they do. So there is bias in what journals publish. It's been accepted openly. It exists across all the journals that you can think of. It's something that we need to live with.
Can I ask a question about communicating effectively with co-authors and setting deadlines, revisions? And we're all busy, but, you know, things can get really sort of long, and do you have effective strategies?
Right. I'll give you my strategy, and then I'll ask Emilia what her strategy is. Typically, what I like to do when I'm the senior author or the first author of a manuscript is have smaller group discussions on authorship. I think an email broadcasting, you know, are you happy with this authorship order, typically does not produce honest answers. Typically, it produces people, there are power inequations within groups where some people cannot answer, and they are likely to give you an answer you want to hear. But I think you deal with the aftermath of discontent more often. So what I try and do is have group meetings, and I think there are statistical contributors. There are other people who contribute with other skills. There are laboratory contributors, and dialogue with them, saying that, you know, here's the way we have put together. Here is a tentative authorship list. What do you think about it? It's tentative, and take that feedback and rearrange the authorship. Typically do that in small groups, and then get back to the larger group that this is what you are sensing as a group consensus. That, again, you know, leave the door open that you're happy to communicate with people. and then they can get back to you. That's a question about determining authorship. It's best done before you have a p-value. It's best done before you have a p-value. It's best done before you choose a journal that you decide to submit it to. Often what happens I see is that there's a natural synergy within groups that sort of builds confidence, and you know, you stop dealing with these issues, but still nice to never forget that they exist over there. In terms of deadlines, typically what we do is that when you send it to a larger group of authors, at Framingham we try to give them 2 weeks, that people are busy, that they have 2 weeks to respond. I leave it to their own conscience to determine whether or not they meet authorship criteria. I tend to be more inclusive than exclusive, because it doesn't go well if you try to exclude people. It's nicer to include people and let them respond to their own conscience. Give them 2 weeks to respond and make it very clear that if they don't respond in 2 weeks, you would assume that they agree with authorship. That if they do not agree with authorship, you'd like to hear. Sometimes, and it deals with select co-authors, I mark request a read receipt for the email and mark it as important. I like to document. That's what I do. Your life is, academic life tends to be very complex. So you have strategies of making sure that people read what you write, they listen, and they have a chance. Typically what I would do is I would give them a second chance. If they don't respond and the person is the director or something, then I'd write a personal email and saying, you know, I missed your response. Maybe I missed it. I know you're busy. Do you want some more time? I think it's okay. There are different people who are busy. You know, it may come at a bad timing. They may be traveling overseas. They may be doing a lot of things may be going on. So I tend not to be dogmatic, but general framework is 2 weeks. Then you reach out and make sure that, you know, people are not, and then it goes out. And like I said, you know, make sure that the first submission to the first journal, people who sign on, they sign on to the manuscript, because there are situations where people may hesitate to sign copyrights, or I've removed a co-author from a galley stage. And that's one of the most embarrassing experiences in my early academic life, after which I decided on the rule that first submission to the first journal, you sign on, then you don't sign off, because then you have to go and explain to an editor why you're changing authorship. Does not go well. Editors don't like it. I don't like it when people come back and say, I want to remove a co-author. It's easier when people want to add a co-author, because sometimes you forget. And, you know, it's okay to add. But removal generally is a complicated matter. Does not go well. Emilia.
In terms of the deadline business, it can be very tricky. One of the things that I increasingly do is if there are deadlines, I include the subject line. And I also alarm it so that it turns red on that day. With some people that are very, very busy. So for instance, I, you know, would like to always be timely. Sometimes I'm not timely, particularly if I'm writing with somebody who's not a good writer and I know it's going to take an enormous amount of time. I now have them book an appointment to meet with me, and I go through the paper with them in person. And it takes them, you know, an hour. They get much more high quality feedback. I used to be embarrassed by that, but I actually think that they get better feedback at having a more timely fashion. So if you're dealing with somebody who's very senior, who's very busy, but you think that they have a substantive contribution, make an appointment and just say, I want to go over the article with you at this time. The other thing that I do with certain people who should go nameless is I not only send the article to them, I send it to their secretary or assistant, so that I have sort of a more public forum where it's obvious that I've sent it. And then the final thing that I will do is I will say, I will assume if I do not hear from you by this date that other obligations, I don't put it in a snarky way, but that other obligations have, you know, led to this not being a high priority for you at this point. You know, glad to have you on the next paper or something, you know. There will be senior people who will hold papers hostages for 6 months to a year. And that worked much better in the past. It works very poorly now because of the sheer competitiveness of all academic fields. It used to be Framingham was one of the few, you know, big cohorts in town. Now we've got, you know, 5 to 10 other studies that we're competing with, and people's careers, you know, young people's careers really depend upon it. And usually, if I have an obstructionist senior author, it's never the young people, it's always the senior people. I make that point to them that really this isn't about, you know, me or them, whatever. This is about this person's career, and need to move on. And most people respond to that. Even in dysfunctional work environments, not that I work in one, people will respond to a clear request to help a junior colleague.
Just a couple of
does that seem right to right. you, what I just said? Do you agree with that or not?
I quite agree. I think one of the other points I want to make is that let's not forget that we want co-author. I'd rather not rush a paper and avoid a co-author input because I need to get it out there, because co-authors are invaluable. They've remarkably enhanced my own contribution over the years. I don't mind waiting an extra week or so. And the second point, you know, expanding on what Emilia says, your article is not published till you've got everything that is needed, including the copyright forms and everything up to a journal. So even when you get acceptance, I think one of the points I didn't really cover, something is accepted does not mean it's published. To get published, you really have to move fast. That means the files have to be uploaded, that the copyright has. So completing the loop on the last few, sometimes it can take weeks. I can give you an example, personal example of a co-author I know who signs copyright forms. And I don't want to read into motives, but would not check a couple of boxes. So what I do for that particular co-author is I remind them when I send the copyright form is that remember to check all the boxes. Greatly appreciated. Because weeks are lost because, you know, it's sent directly to the journal. It's sent directly to the journal. And then you find out 2 weeks later that so-and-so's authorship form is not really complete, so the manuscript is deficient. I want to lose 2 weeks. Personally, I don't care, but usually you work with people whose career, you know, timely publication is important. So when you understanding co-author behavior during the manuscript process is important. And having strategies to proactively and in a nice way. Because what is the goal? The goal is to publish together. And the goal is, you know, that's what I talked about. The goal is actually beyond this manuscript. The goal is that you want to work as part of a multidisciplinary team. And you want to enjoy the process. You want to feel good about it. You want to feel good about the next manuscript. So thinking of strategies by which you can get around what is normal behavior. It may appear erratic to you, but it may be human behavior as a spectrum. Some of it may be erratic by different standards. But being aware of it and having strategies to deal with them becomes very important. Especially, it's easier when Emilia and I work within a common group of authors. So we fine-tune our responses to behavior or patterns. Not to sound critical, but they are just individual behavior patterns. And
right. So, for instance, with sometimes Vossen will say, "I can't do it now. I've got a grant deadline. I'll get to it a week after that." Well, then you're done. Then you know what's and vice versa. Or sometimes I'll say, "I just can't get to it in a timely fashion." That's what adults do.
Another strategy is that for the senior authors, often give them the option of going one after the other, because you know if you are the recipient of multiple comments and multiple drafts, it's a nightmare. So what we try and do is that we do in series that somebody goes first and we work it out amongst themselves. So then I would say, you know, why don't the senior authors work out amongst themselves what order they want to critique this manuscript? That makes it efficient for the first author or the senior author who's sending around the manuscript, that you get, you know, series of comments added, layered on top of each other. And I think one other issue which is worth thinking about is that sometimes when senior authors make comments and you don't incorporate them, it's nice to explain why you don't incorporate them. Because sometimes they can feel touchy about it. It has happened to me. So I'm very proactive. I either meet one-on-one or I explain to them why I think it's different. At the end of the day, I think you got to remember that manuscripts are not written by a committee. The first author and the senior author take responsibility for that process. So you take the responsibility, it's your manuscript, and different people have a chance to offer their opinion. You consider it carefully, you respond to them, and then you know you decide.
That also, by the way, goes for the peer review process, where there will be times when a reviewer will insist on something that you think is inappropriate or wrong. And what I do is I usually defer to the editor. I try to explain in a very courteous, I never am disrespectful to reviewer. One will always lose that. But I'll say, it's the Framingham policy not to put p-values on table one, because that is not the hypothesis that we seek to test, and this manuscript deals with a subset of larger. Boom. And usually people will acquiesce if you don't do it in a kind of confrontational fashion. So don't let a reviewer take, I've seen reviewers destroy good manuscripts, and you don't have to do everything that a reviewer says. Very careful what you don't agree with. Sometimes I'll put that in a reviewer's table. so that they don't think I'm hiding something at all.
Some of the other strategies that I think you can use along the lines is that you could take the position that if the editors and the reviewers feel strongly, you're happy to reconsider it, that at this particular time you feel that this is the way we do things. But if they feel strongly and it would considerably enhance a manuscript, we are happy to reconsider it. That leaves the door open that you're not saying I won't do it. You're saying that I have some reservations. The second strategy which I found useful sometimes, and it often happens, is that reviewer one, reviewer two are asking you to do opposite things. So don't play them against each other. Try not to play them against each other, but try to, you know, tread this carefully, saying that, you know, there are multiple ways of viewing this, and as is evident from the other reviewers' comments, that this could be viewed, and we hope the reviewer understands, that's not a phraseology actually, we hope the reviewer agrees that there are multiple ways of doing this and we have chosen one, but happy to revisit it. The more you work with the reviewers tend to be very knowledgeable. They also, like all of us, tend to be very egoistic. They have spent time reviewing it. They feel hurt if their comments are not considered thoughtfully. So I think responding to them proactively as you can really enhances the chance of submission. Some people, they draw a table where they put the reviewer, you know, a summary for the in the cover letter to the editor that here are major changes made, reviewer one, reviewer two, especially major reanalyses are required, that done, that this is what is done. So at a glance, the more, what I do as a editor and as a reviewer is that I often would read carefully the response to the reviewers, and I like to see everything over there so that I don't have to go back to the manuscript to cross-check, you know, page 11, paragraph 2, line 5, that you paste the responses in the review, so you make it easy for them. The more, they're all busy people, they've taken out time, we're very grateful for them for doing that, and if it comes across that you're making their life easy, they make our life easy.
I just want to make one other point. If your manuscript gets rejected by a high-impact journal and you take the manuscript, change the format, and resubmit it immediately without making any changes, you have to expect that you'll get at least one and sometimes multiple same reviewers. They have taken an extraordinary amount of time, and I find it's peer review for a reason. They're trying to make your science better. I think it's deeply offensive not to make some changes in response to the peer review process. And it tends to go very poorly when you get the same reviewer, particularly if they think, you know, they perceive that they've made reasonable things to make the paper better. In fact, I've seen people just literally cut and paste the same review and say, you know, you might want to follow this.
That's a great point. I think the New England Journal and JAMA, for example, I can guarantee you at least one of the reviewers is common if it goes in the direction, rejected
exactly
by one, goes to the other. And my own philosophy is...
Or even JAMA CERC. I mean, that's very common.
My own philosophy, and this has been written about in the literature, is that I'm not sure, this is a very personal viewpoint, whether I would review a manuscript again that I've rejected for a major journal. I would write back and say, I've reviewed it for a major journal. I would like to excuse myself. Generally, because I think you've said your viewpoint, you want to give the authors another chance with another set of reviewers. But some people will review it and will write in their comments that, I just reviewed it, the author didn't make any changes, and they're very displeased about it.
Can you give the editor's perspective on what happens to paper when the authors have, you know, sent it back and attempted to address, you know, some of the reviewers' concerns?
Right. I think when it comes back, what I can... the same reviewers. And we would also at some stage obtain it. For circulation, we have a statistical review. And I think the editor typically would do is that, what I try to do is save them the trouble. If I find that they have not responded to any reviewer comments, I would shoot off an email and say that maybe you want to reconsider revising this because it's not as responsive. Otherwise, just waste their time that they send it to the reviewers, and the reviewers are going to say, yeah, they're not responding. So as an editor, I would take the prerogative of giving them an input in between. Usually, 90% of the time, I think people are very responsive, in which ways it would go to the same two reviewers. We could choose to pick a non-statistical third reviewer as well. And I think we often do that when I see that, you know, they say, we really can't do additional experiments, that we are markedly limited or whatever. Is that a reasonable argument? Is that not a reasonable argument? I know what the reviewer thinks, because the reviewer said you have to do those experiments. So then I would also seek a third reviewer who would see the responses to the initial review as well. So they often would take a third reviewer. Like I said, editors, if we really like something, we try to be proactive. But by and large, we have to get a sense that the responses are, you know, point by point, they are very responsive to each of the things that are said. And then it goes to those reviewers, then it sort of comes back. Then you again present it to the editorial board where you say that, you know, typically it would go like this, that we reviewed this manuscript and here were the strengths, here were the major issues pointed out by the reviewers. And here's what this resubmission does. They responded to this by doing this, to this by doing this, this by doing this. What do I think? It's nearly there, but they didn't respond to one point. And during my second review of the manuscript, this can happen. I now find that I discovered something I hadn't. So sometimes, you know, authors get frustrated that why didn't they tell me the first time? That's because I think you're viewing this from a different lens each time. And, you know, sometimes we are human, we are not as attentive, or, you know, we miss a point when we first read it. But we want the best product in the journal. So we'd still get back and say, here's something that we'd still like you to do. So editors are not entirely always consistent. I think you have to bear with them. What I can tell you is they tend to be pro authors. They tend to work hard. They tend to think a lot about the impact on careers by rejections. My email is vasan@bu.edu. If you have any questions about manuscripts or authorship or anything, I'm happy to meet and talk. I think these are extraordinarily important areas because careers are determined by publication records. Not very simple. We all learn all the time. Still learning. Not yet there. Maybe someday. Yes.
And I guess I'm trying to figure out the rationale, because I feel like that's what we should discuss. And it's unnerving to actually know the person is not here, which normally you could guess. But it's like when the names are right there, I mean, okay, yeah, I can better identify interest, but I don't understand why it's just, and maybe it's not the case with the high levels, but when I get articles now and I get asked to review, I see the whole thing.
I can tell you why the shift has been made. I think the shift has been made to emphasize greater transparency. The editorial process was a black box. I, for one, believe, it's my personal philosophy, it's not the journal's philosophy circulation, that reviewers can publish their names, because if I'm, you know, I should be able to tell you to your face what I think about your work. I need to say it nicely. Clearly, the tone of the reviews improves dramatically when the names start getting published. And they are not as harsh. That's just a human observation. It's likely to happen. But I think it's like most processes. I think you gain when the process is transparent. You know who's reviewing it. I think the downside of that is that, I think we have heard this comment from circulation editors that they were attacked by somebody at a meeting because they sensed that they had handled the paper or whatever. And it can happen that publication of names invites open, you know, attack on the person. But I think you have to build a code of conduct as you change the process, that I think it's okay. We, just like we put the editorial board's name, we put editorial policy. I think it's okay to publish the reviewers' names, and, you know, people can tell. I think some journals like BMJ give you the option. They give you the option of either publishing it or not publishing it.
You were talking about, I was talking about the other way, when you're reading it, when you're being asked to review, whereas previously manuscripts would be sent and now I always think. And so I wonder to what extent there's concerns that you're hearing there, because, you know, and so maybe suddenly there's new bias because it's a highly respected group versus like, oh, I've never heard these people in Australia or like, you know, Saudi Arabia that are sending me these articles. So you read it with a different lens as a reviewer, not purposefully, but unconsciously, like you may have a different lens because you're not as enamored with the name.
Right.
And is there a concern about that? I used to think that everything was blinded, but it's not blinded, or at least the article I get.
Right. I think the American Journal of Cardiology used to do that. They would have us remove Framingham anywhere in the manuscript or whatever. I think what happens is that, again, I think we need to recalibrate ourselves to greater transparency, because I think as a reviewer, I can figure out based on how you cite, how you write, how you spell, I can make out whether you're from Europe or you're from the UK. So your ways and means of looking at it and making the determination, if you really are hell-bent on finding out who is this group that you get, I think trying to live with greater transparency and not having something published in WikiLeaks is a good idea. It's nicer to put it out there ourselves and, you know, say it over there. I think almost everything that we do, I think communication and transparency seem to be the name of the game. Put it out there and say it as it is. It does create a bias. It's not fair. I think groups with greater reputation are more likely to be published. It's not a very fair world. I think non-English speaking authors have a major disadvantage. I think some of the editorial policies sort of advocate that they get assistance from English speaking authors. I think I was reading an article talking about the trajectory of publications in China versus United States, and you know, China has really taken off, and I think what's different is the kind of forum in which the Chinese authors are publishing. I think the scientific world is relatively losing out the benefit of information on large series being done in China unless we help disseminate that research, because there could be a lot of things that we could gain. So it's a moving target. I think we have done in circulation, written back to the authors and said that they get the help of an English-speaking author to make the editorial process smoother, because you really don't have the time to rewrite articles. And I think Milia and I have struggled with this a few times where a manuscript is in the works of 1 year because the grammar or the English is just not, and it's not the author's fault. I think they never got direct feedback that they need to get assistance and get somebody involved, invite that person to be a co-author. It's a slippery slope, because then you have the phenomenon of ghostwriting, that you know, you have an author who just basically contributes the English and, you know, who turns it around. And the flip side of that is now I find papers that people align themselves with groups who can help them write, and it's a mixed bag. How do you, do they meet the authorship criteria? But I've seen groups that earlier we gave this feedback now come back with a couple of English speaking authors who are in prominent positions because it wouldn't otherwise make it. Personally, I don't judge that. I leave it to the authors to decide how they decide who is part of them. As long as it reads well, reads in English, and good signs, we'll publish it.